Because if they did not do it the right way, Don, they could totally tank the mortgage market. If you think the financial crisis was bad before, that would just be a disaster.
I'm Don Bernard, the principal in charge of Baker Tilly's multifamily housing practice. Welcome to a special edition, post-election episode of Buzz House, a Baker Tilly podcast where you can hear all the buzz around multifamily housing. Today, we are joined by David Gasson of the Housing Advisory Group to discuss the 2024 election and how we anticipate the results will impact the multifamily housing industry. Let's get started. David, thank you so much for being with us today.
It is always a pleasure. It's nice to be here.
Very good. And of course, Housing Advisory Group, its mission is to educate members of Congress, senators, their staffs, and administration officials on the value of the low-income housing tax credit and other affordable housing programs. We'll be talking with David today about what we can expect regarding housing legislation and programs, of course, post the November election. We're going to jump right into our discussion with David. David, before we get into some detailed questions, again, maybe just let our listeners give some insight into your background and work, of course, with the Housing Advisory Group.
Sure, absolutely. And for those who I have not had the pleasure to meet yet, I'm David Gasson. I've been in the affordable housing business for well over, boy, Don, now 30, 35 years. I can't keep track, actually. I guess when you get to some point, you just stop counting. We've been doing it for a long time. I worked on Capitol Hill before joining Boston Capital in 95. I worked on Capitol Hill for 10 years, first in the House and then in the Senate. And now have been doing affordable housing issues for that period of time. The Housing Advisory Group is a national advocacy organization that was set up in 93 to deal with the sunsetting of the tax credit in 93, which of course became permanent. And we have been working to advocate on behalf of the tax credit and broader housing issues since then, and are happy to say that we have had far more many successes than not. And we look forward to continuing that on the road ahead.
Very good. And David, thank you for all your efforts, of course, for that, and the industry is large as well. So, David, let's start with the balance of 2024. And the questions are, what can happen, if anything? Anything? We hear some things maybe around disaster relief. Is that low-hanging fruit? Or what's your take on the lame duck session?
So, first of all, they are looking very much forward to getting out of town for Thanksgiving. They're already tired of each other after only being back for a couple of weeks since the election. But they obviously have to address the budget. The continuing resolution on the FY 2025 budget expires December 20th. So they will come back after the Thanksgiving holiday next week and start dealing with how they're going to address funding for the government. Odds are, Don, that they are going to pass another continuing resolution to get them into next year. They initially would have liked not to have done that. They wanted to give President-elect Trump a clean slate when he was inaugurated on January 20th, and not have to deal with any budgetary issues. He had to do that when he was elected in 2016, and he came in 2017, and it took up a lot of bandwidth for them passing the budget back then. They wanted to try to avoid that, but there's really no way around it. The margins are very close in the House, and they just cannot come to an agreement on a lot of the appropriations bills. So it was very unlikely they were going to come to an agreement on a full year's budget by the end of this year, calendar year. So they will pass a CR more than likely to get them into January or February and try to quickly pass a budget and get it off of the table. Right along with that, we are pretty confident they will pass a disaster supplemental. They need to fund FEMA and they need to fund the disaster fund at the Small Business Administration to get those resources out to folks who suffered from Helene and Milton and some of the other natural disasters around the country. It is possible they could also attach a disaster tax credit provision that originated in the House and was part of the Wyden-Stube tax bill. This would provide a tax credit for individuals that were in presidentially declared disaster areas that would allow them to deduct some of the expenses and costs that they have incurred due to those natural disasters. We have been trying like a Dickens to try to include LIHTC in everything. As Senator Cantwell says, any horse that goes through town will try to jump on and have LIHTC ride that horse. We are not expecting to be successful in that regard. They pretty much walled off the supplemental bill for just the disaster relief and potentially this tax provision. We'll see what else happens, and there may be some other small things that ride along with it, but likely not anything on the housing front. So that will take up all the bandwidth they have available in the lame duck session. And then we look forward to coming back January 3rd when the new Congress comes in.
Very good. Thank you for that, David. David, turning over to the actual results of the election, would you be able to address what we know about leadership in the various committees that touch around housing policy?
Yeah. So there will be some changes. A lot of the main characters remaining the same, minus in the Senate, of course. But Jason Smith will be back as chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Republican from Missouri. Richie Neal will remain ranking member, Democrat from Massachusetts. We are still not sure who the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee will be. It could be Andy Barr, but or French Hill. But there are still four people up for contention for chair of financial services, and Maxine Waters from California will remain ranking member. On the Senate side, Senator Mike Crapo from Idaho will finally become chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and Ron Wyden, the current chairman, will be a ranking member, Democrat from Oregon. And then big changes on the Senate Banking Committee. Obviously, Sherrod Brown was defeated for re-election in Ohio. Democrats will be in the minority in the Senate. So the new chairman of the Senate Banking Committee will be Tim Scott from South Carolina. And their ranking member will be Elizabeth Warren from here in Massachusetts. That will prove an interesting duo. We'll see what comes out of the Banking Committee and how well they get along, which they will get along. I mean, as we always tell people, you hear a lot of noise when you follow these things in the press and you think that they don't like each other, nothing ever gets done, and they don't work together. And they actually do work really well together below the radar to get things done. They might not always agree, and it might be difficult sometimes, but the mechanisms in Congress do work, mainly in the Senate. The House can be a little difficult. And of course, as we've seen from this current Congress, which will continue, as we'll discuss in the next Congress, with the margins being so slim in the House, a lot of the consternation has taken place between Republicans and the Republican conference. Democrats haven't even engaged in the conversation. It's Republican on Republican. That will likely continue, and we'll talk about that a little bit down the podcast.
Perfect. Perfect. Thank you so much, David. David, in the past, we've talked about the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act, right, which has a lot of efficiencies and maybe expansions of certain things. Is this still the main tool that could provide these updates to the tax credit program? And if so, do you see a path? Or what is the path?
You know, Don, the short answer is yes. The AHCIA, the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act, is our primary vehicle for advancing tax legislation for the low-income housing tax credit. Now, that said, I want to make a point, and it's a broader point. Senator Cantwell used to always harangue us about her colleagues to say that, you know, the industry has to do more to let her colleagues know that there's a housing crisis. Well, guess what? All of her colleagues now know there's a housing crisis. The bipartisan support for the AHCIA is through the roof. I believe we have over currently 277 bipartisan co-sponsors in the House and 37 bipartisan senators in the Senate on the bill. And the point that we like to make is that no other tax provision in Congress has as many bipartisan co-sponsors as the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act. But going along with that and the fact that the housing crisis is widespread, hardly a week went by in this last session where a member of Congress, some on the tax writing committees and some off, introduced a housing bill. Some of them gave us a heads up that they were doing it and we'd work with them. And some of them literally came out of the blue and were like, wait, what? and we saw these housing bills everywhere. So there are a lot of housing bills out there. Some of them duplicate what we're doing in the AHCIA. Some of them take AHCIA provisions and take them a step further, maybe further than the industry would actually like them to go, above and beyond what the economics of the affordable housing marketplace could actually handle, but their intentions are good in presenting them. And then some of them are really well-meaning but left-field ideas, you know, that folks come up with that we will then go into the office and say, hey, we love your housing bill. Can we talk to you about it? And we'll explain to them what might work, what might not work, and how they might want to tweak it. But in the end, we hope that they come on board with the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act, because that is our vehicle. So the AHCIA will be reintroduced in the next Congress. Obviously, we've been talking with the lead sponsors of the bill in the House and the Senate about that for some time, playing through the different scenarios depending on what happened in the election. So at this point, we do not believe, Don, there will be many changes to the bill, because with one-party rule in Washington, they will be using the reconciliation process, which we will talk about, to pass it. And that is probably not going to give us a lot of opportunity to change the current bill, because when you change the legislation, then you have to re-educate everybody again on the different changes you've made. And we just don't think we're going to have that kind of time with them likely to pass the bill through reconciliation. It's going to be a much shorter time frame on when they finally start voting on this bill. There are some things that could change. We're waiting to see if the leads want to change the 50% test, because as you are aware, many of your listeners might be, it did pass the House, but at 30% and not 25%. Obviously, it did not pass the Senate. We came up short there, but the leads might say, listen, we've already had one vote and it was widely supported at the 30% level versus 25. Maybe we'll bump it up to 30. So we'll have to wait and see on that. Other than that, I don't see a lot of changes to the bill. And with the reconciliation process, and if you'd like to talk about that, I can explain to you exactly how that works and what is relevant in the AHCIA in the context of how we fit into that bill and what we can and cannot offer through reconciliation.
Very good. Very good. And I'm sure, David, that will probably tie into my next question. Really, you know, a lot of on people's minds is, expecting in general with the tax legislation here in 2025, people are always asking about the corporate tax rate. And I know there's maybe some nuances there, but I know it's a big question, but maybe some highlights of what we could expect to see.
Yeah, I mean, there has been talk about the corporate tax rate. President-elect Trump indicated on the campaign trail that he would like to go to a 15% corporate rate. And then he kind of qualified it and said 15% rate for manufacturing. And of course, everybody wants to see the economy grow in manufacturing. There has not been consensus support among Democrats or Republicans, for that matter, on lowering the corporate rate further. First of all, and this is something that still matter to some people, it would be incredibly expensive. I believe that the data point is for every point you lower the corporate rate, you're talking about $101 billion. So to go from a 21% rate down to a 15% rate across the board. So if, say, if you weren't limiting it to manufacturing, but you were going broad-based 15% rate for everybody, you're talking somewhere in the area potentially of $700 billion just for that, before you even start talking about the expiring provisions from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And the Joint Committee on Taxation and the Congressional Budget Office have come out with estimates from anywhere between $3.5 and $4.4 trillion just to renew the expiring provisions from the TCJA. That does not count any of the things people want to add, for instance, FITEC, new markets, Neighborhood Homes Investment Act, a myriad of other tax provisions outside of housing that people would like to see addressed in the tax bill. So to lower the corporate rate that much would really bump up the cost of the bill, which now people are, I've heard estimations, Don, that people are talking that the bill could end up costing upwards of $7 trillion with a T, not a B, a T. That's a lot of money. We'll see what happens. I mean, all of us have learned never to say never. I mean, we'll never say never again, you know, in regards to anything. If we haven't learned, this election taught us again, never say never. But I think it's going to be difficult for the president and Republicans who do support a lower corporate rate to really drive that down if they also want to include a lot of these other tax provisions in the bill. So that one, not so much. Other things that could get included, and of course, something that hasn't been on the table before, but neighborhood homes is a perfect example. Strong bipartisan support, a single-family housing for first-time home buyers that qualify in blighted communities at reduced rates, because you're giving the developers a tax credit to rehab their, basically build out the new home from the existing home. And so that drives down the cost. First-time home buyers, they'd have to hold the property for 5 years, and they could, and when they sold it, they would have to again sell it to a qualifying home buyer who would have to hold the home. So that's a fascinating program that has strong bipartisan support. There are a number of other programs like that. So we could see a number of additions that people offer up for this tax bill that they're going to be addressing next year. And that's before you and I even start talking about LIHTC.
Right. Very good. Very good. David, just a couple other maybe random questions, checking in on a few items that have been out there for a while in general. You know, those are there any expectations around GSE reform? And two, you know, what is the status of CRA?
Yeah, on GSE reform, it's going to be on the table again, because we've been doing the seesaw. And you know, both of those conversations kind of go in tandem with each other, CRA and GSE reform. So let's start with CRA first, Don. Let's do that because it'll make the other one make more sense. So when the first Trump administration came in, The new head of the OCC decided that they wanted to redo the Community Reinvestment Act. They wanted to rewrite. Now, typically, any changes to that are done by the three regulators, the OCC, the Fed, and the FDIC. Well, the Fed and the FDIC were not on board with what the OCC wanted to do. So the OCC, for the first time, actually on its own, rewrote the Community Reinvestment Act regulations and had an interesting process to do so. But they rewrote them and they finally came out. And obviously, the industry wasn't crazy about it because it really lessened the extent for community development and investment in low-income housing tax credits. And we were obviously very nervous about that. President Biden gets elected in 2020. And one of the first things they do when they come out is say, we're dumping the Trump era CRA rewrite that they did, which everybody was like, great, we're relieved on that. And then the three regulators together came to said, no, we're going to rewrite it like we always have. And they got together and started to redo CRA. They came up with a proposal. They had a lot of feedback from everybody who was involved in the CRA process, housing, financial institutions, and the such. And they passed the new CRA regs. Well, not long after they passed them, a suit was filed by a number of folks. And currently the case lies down in Texas, the appeals court down in Texas. No action has been taken on it, no discovery or anything, but it's down there. And they put a stay on enacting any of the CRA regs that were established. And now, of course, we've had another change in administrations. So what we're waiting to find out is whether or not the Trump 2.0 administration and their new head of the OCC and their new head of the FDIC, everybody relatively thinks Jerome Powell's going to stay at the Fed, so that might not change. But the regulators might decide they want to do it all over again. It'll be an interesting conversation between the new folks and the folks at the Fed. And if they do, then the Biden era legislation currently down in Texas could get tossed. You know, hey, you know, appeals court, you're off the hook. Don't worry about it. Toss the case because we're going to rewrite CRA. So we don't know if that's the case yet. But what we're telling people is the status quo that existed before the 2017 Trump administration, those are the CRA rules today. They will likely remain the CRA rules for quite some time until either the legal process plays forward on what's going on down in Texas or the Trump era regulators decide to rewrite it. And then that's a whole nother period of time that's going to take for if they got it done for those to take effect. So it's in limbo. So just go along with what we knew was in place in 2016. And that's the status quo. GSEs is a similar situation. President Trump had wanted to address the GSEs and the conservatorship when he was in office the first time, but then COVID hit and everything got blown up. Everything got sidetracked and they could not follow through on that. There is a lot of conversation now on them wanting to take the GSEs out of conservatorship and return them to private ownership. But to do that, they would absolutely have to do it the right way. They would have to make sure that they are properly capitalized. And everybody is pretty much convinced that they would still have to be a very much implied government backstop to that market. Because if they did not do it the right way, Don, they could totally tank the mortgage market. If you think the financial crisis was bad before, that would just be a disaster. And to think what would happen with markets, rates, and the such. So yes, we believe they will make an attempt and go through the process of potentially taking the entities out of conservatorship. But I think everybody's going to caution them on the way in which they do that. And we'll be watching that closely and weighing in, obviously, where we can.
Sure. No, very good. Thanks for those updates. David, this has been a great discussion. I really appreciate the insight. Just, you know, one last additional question. We always like to end with advocacy. Are there any special considerations right now, or it's kind of do what we've been doing, or any advice on advocacy?
Absolutely. And it gets back to something that I kind of touched on before, but if we have time, Don, I'd like to discuss a little further. And the advocacy is going to be around the reconciliation process.
Oh, perfect. Yes, please do. Yes.
Yeah. So how this is going to work with reconciliation, what reconciliation means, it's a budget process. And it means that in the Senate, they only need 50 votes to pass any piece of legislation around the budget reconciliation and the tax bill. They would not need a 60-vote filibuster-proof majority, only 50 votes, which means that one party can get this done. Now, as a point of history, this is how the George W. Bush tax cuts got done. It's how the Affordable Care Act was passed in the Obama administration. It's how the Trump tax cuts got done, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. and it is how the infrastructure bill got passed by the Biden administration. It was all one party rule, and one party voted it in without the other party participated, but they didn't need their votes. They are thinking they're going to do the same thing this time around with reconciliation and the tax bill. Now, the thing I'd like to point out to people is this: the difference between now and all those other scenarios, minus the Biden situation, which was the same, but it was Democrats who had the thin majority, and they managed to keep everybody together, especially Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema, and they were on board, which is how they passed the infrastructure bill. Republicans have not had the same luck, especially with this House and a very thin majority. They are going to have an equally thin majority, if more so. And I say more so because President Trump has been tapping House members to serve in his administration. So they could very well have a 1, 2, or 3 seat majority in the House as they try to pass the largest tax bill that has ever passed Congress. In the Senate, they only have 53 seats. And they're going to have to get every single one of those 53 senators to agree to everything in this tax bill. So when you think about it, it's kind of hard to imagine with a House that has a hard time on agreeing on the name of a post office and getting all the Republicans to agree to that, that they're going to agree to a $5 to $7 trillion tax bill and everything that's in it. And as a reminder, the president made a lot of promises in the campaign: eliminate taxes on tips, eliminate taxes on Social Security, which does have bipartisan support, lower the corporate rate to 15%. One of the big ones, which is going to have a lot of problem with his Republican colleagues, is eliminating the cap on the salt tax. He said that a number of times that he wanted to get rid of the salt cap. That does not have support among a majority of Republicans in the House and the Senate. So they're going to have to craft a bill that can get every single one of the Republicans in the House, or at least 218 out of potentially 221 or 22 of them, to agree to this to do it through reconciliation. And the same in the Senate. They're going to have to get all 50. They're going to have to get 50 out of 53 senators on board to support this thing. And I just think that's a heavy lift. So I'm calling it reconciliation plus. I think that they will have to negotiate with the Democrats and allow some of what they want to do in there so that they can get Democratic votes, at least in the Senate, to get them over that 50 vote margin. I could be wrong. You never know. They might be able to get unanimity through the Republican conferences. But I just think this is with the largest bill that a Congress has ever passed. I think it's going to be difficult to get every single House member on the Republican conference and then all but two Republican senators in the Senate on board for this. Now, in regards to LIHTC, we are very much pushing for as much as we can get from the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act into the bill. There is something called the Byrd Rule, named after Senator Robert Byrd, who was the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee back in the day, and he established this. The Byrd Rule says that anything that is included in reconciliation has to have a revenue effect. Either it has to cost money or it has to raise money. So this eliminates the ability of including regulatory reforms that have no revenue impact, messaging provisions that don't have any revenue impact, that just you want to send a message out there, do something, or change a regulation on the ability to do something, but it has no revenue impact. They cannot be included in reconciliation. So that's going to limit our ability to include probably 7 to 10 provisions from the AHCA in the bill, because they are largely regulatory in nature and do not have a revenue impact. So they'd be off the table. Obviously, we're pushing for the restoration of the 12.5% and a bump in the 9% credit. As you and I discussed, a reduction of the 50% test down to something, whether it's 25, 30% or something else, and basis boosts. We would like to get some of the basis boosts included as well. And so we are pushing those and as much as else as we can get, you know, bond recycling, I mean, different things that could have a revenue impact. The 10-year rule, we have to see if that has a revenue impact. But we're trying to push things and get as much as we can in the tax bill. We think we will be successful. Our leads are still our leads, and they are still there, including the Republicans now that are in charge in the House and the Senate. Jason Smith, chairman of Ways and Means, is a longtime supporter of the credit and was the co-author with Senator Wyden of the Wyden-Smith bill, which included our LIHTC provisions. And Mike Crapo has for years voiced his support for affordable housing over and over again. Well, now he's going to have the opportunity to demonstrate it as the chairman of the Finance Committee that's going to draft their version of the tax bill and make sure that affordable housing is included in there. So we're feeling relatively confident. I've used it so many times, but there really is no reason now, with housing being the number one crisis in the country on everybody's mind. It was in the top three of every voter's poll that came out before and after the election of the things that are concerning them. It's the number one driver of inflation in the country. And obviously Republicans and President-elect Trump want to address inflation. So we feel confident that they are going to finally address affordable housing in the tax bill. And we are working really hard to make sure that's the case.
That's very exciting.
So in advocacy, that's the question you asked on advocacy.
Yeah.
We need everybody on board. We need you as we always do, but now more than ever, to get to your elected officials and let them know if you want to do something about the housing crisis, make sure that the low-income housing tax credit is included in the tax bill. We are going to be relatively inexpensive with what we want compared to a lot of the other provisions that will be in the tax bill. We do not have a score, but we're going to be in the tens of billions of dollars versus the hundreds of billions of dollars, but it's going to have a big effect. And the more we can get, the more we can address the housing crisis. So we need everybody to do what they've done times 10. Advocate with your elected officials. Advocate with the committee chairman and the members of the tax writing committees. Advocate if you know members of the leadership, Majority Leader Thune from South Dakota, Speaker Johnson from Louisiana, and their lieutenants underneath them, and just make sure that they understand that if they really want to move the country along and address the number one economic issue in the country, the low-income housing tax credit is a damn good start, and that's where they should start.
Very good. Thank you so much, David.
It is my pleasure, Don. Always good to see you and talk with you.
That's it for this episode of The Bus House, catching up with David Gasson of the Housing Advisor Group, discussing implications to our affordable housing industry from the recent election. Once again, I'm Don Bernards.
Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. For additional resources around multifamily housing, check out BakerTilly.com. If you have a suggestion for the show, email us at buildabakertilly.com. That's BUILD@BakerTilly.com. See you next time on Buzz House.